My name is Jeff Callahan. I'm an engineer at Nordstrom. We actually have a technology department at Nordstrom. It's not just selling shoes and clothes. So I work in the supply chain side of technology, and we've been working hard the last couple years to modernize the supply chain, given a lot of the changes that we've seen in our customers and our business. So today I'm going to talk about kind of the high-level approach. It's probably not going to get as technical as the last talk, but I pretty much had my hands in the whole thing, so if we want to go deep into something, I'm happy to just ask. But I'm going to try to really lay out, you know, how we attack the problem and what we learn from it. So, here's what I'm looking to cover, a little bit about who Nordstrom is and how our supply chain has been evolving. And then we'll start looking at the solution that we came up with. And then we'll talk about a specific sort of long-term project that we're working on at Nordstrom called cost-based routing. That's kind of like our holy grail in the supply chain. We're just now scratching the surface on that. And then we'll talk a little bit about some of the issues going to production and what we're looking to do next. So Nordstrom, I don't know how many of you shop there, whatnot, but founded in Seattle in 1901. I worked out of the Seattle office. Family-owned, the whole, or operated. Now we're publicly traded, so not entirely family-owned. We've had an online presence since 98, and here you could kind of see how we've grown in terms of the number of stores. So 115 stores operating nationwide today, and then there's quite a few fulfillment facilities behind the scenes. So the customer has really changed a lot for us in the last 25 years. Like I mentioned, we went online. That's now driving 30% of our sales, which was $12 billion last year, the online sales. Our customers expect a lot more flexibility. They want to know when they can get things, where they can get it, and at what cost. So that's what we're working with in today's environment. So how Nordstrom kind of approached this is we introduced new facility formats, general purpose fulfillment centers, which are kind of like what you would think of with Amazon. And then the vertical optimized fulfillment centers. These are interesting. They handle subsets of our SKUs like beauty. That tend to be very small, like a package of lipstick, you know, some makeup you apply to your face. They're very small. You handle them in a totally different way, and so we've kind of optimized different facilities just for these types of SKUs. So it's kind of interesting to me. And then these Nordstrom local stores are a new store type that doesn't actually hold inventory, but instead they provide a place where customers can go to pick up their orders. If they got a pair of pants, they can schedule some alterations to them. It's kind of more of a touch point for us with our customers. And then we've introduced new fulfillment options, like BOPUS, we call it, courier delivery. We'll even use Uber in some cases to send your package, your order over to you. Next day pickup, where we'll transfer something from one store to another, where it, you know, maybe it'll land in your neighborhood. So these are some of the new capabilities that we've introduced into the supply chain at Nordstrom. Now I just want to talk like about one of these kind of specific cases. This may be a little hard to see, but that's okay. This is basically the set of Nordstrom stores in the Los Angeles area. You can see they're kind of spread out all over. There's a couple different colors. We'll talk about that in a minute. But what we're trying to do here is, instead of building multiple massive fulfillment centers, we want to look at this entire network as one single fulfillment center, where all of the inventory is available at all of the stores, just given a certain amount of time. So working with the business side, they kind of drew up this four-leaf clover plan for accomplishing this shared inventory network. And so in the middle, this green thing is what they call like a hub, local omni hub. It holds inventory, but it doesn't accept customers. There's no retail services there. So it's strictly like a back-end facility. Then there's full-line stores. These are the Nordstrom that we all know, we've been to. And then there's that new concept in pink. It's the local store, where it's kind of the converse of the Omni Hub. It doesn't hold any inventory, but it offers an array of retail services. So that previous map, this is how they drew it up in terms of having trucks that are constantly circulating through all of these stores, and they call it the four-leaf clover. And so what we need to understand is how inventory spread across here, how we get it to one of the other locations that a customer wants it at. So a couple questions that we would want to ask. If a customer orders socks, shoes, and a jacket, and they're at these different parts of the four-leaf clover, but then they want to pick it up down here, then, you know, when can they pick it up? So we have to, you know, there's a lot of variables in play there. And then how much does that cost for Nordstrom? And that's really, I mean, as long as we're meeting the customer expectations, the next priority for us is always going to be minimizing the cost. And I mean that in like a, not necessarily a pure dollar sense, but sort of the general cost to Nordstrom. So you can see it can get a little complicated. And as soon as you look at this across the entire country, where we have, like I said, 115 stores and a bunch of back-end facilities of different types, it gets really complex really quickly. There's a lot of variables. So, you know, we have the different facility types creating this heterogeneous network. Inventory is constantly selling, moving. So we have to know where the inventory is and how soon it's going to be available. Staffing can obviously affect these things. So if a store doesn't have enough staff to go out on the floor and pick items to ship, then it's going to be hard to get it on that truck so they can make it to where the customer wants it. And then, of course, if there's trucks on the road, in LA no less, then traffic can definitely be a big factor. So this kind of explains, motivates the solution that we came up with. LA is one example. We're rolling these out in New York, Houston, Chicago, and I imagine they're going to kind of take over the whole Nordstrom network. So let's transition now to kind of the solution. Our priorities then are first to satisfy our shoppers, flexibility, precision, and accuracy. Are their priorities. And flexibility is the when, where, at what cost. Precision is, instead of saying, you know, you could get it between 9/21 and 9/26, they want to know you'll have it by 3 p.m. on 9/23. And then accuracy, of course, is, you know, what we all think of it. One customer that Nordstrom hasn't historically done a good job of taking care of our facility and asset managers. As the technology side of the supply chain, we have to serve both the physical supply chain and the customers who are ordering things off there. So if one store gets overwhelmed with orders, that facility manager needs to, you know, maybe take them offline from receiving more orders, or they have a stake in the outcomes, and the things they care about are efficiency, predictability, control. Because this the problem space seemed to be exploding, we realized we wanted to partner with data science. We have a data science org, and this was a big priority for us. It needed to be adaptable. A lot of these new, like the four-leaf clover, those are experiments that the business wants to try all the time, and so these are, relative to how we used to model things, these are radical new ideas, and we expect that we're going to be facing a constant stream of these types of ideas, so we need a system that's adaptable and that can support that kind of experimentation. And then there's we needed to work within the Nordstrom technology ecosystem. Kubernetes is a big part of what we do at Nordstrom. Everything I do is through Kubernetes. I don't remember the last time I logged in to the AWS console. So, Kubernetes, we really prioritize working on that. And then there's an interesting one where a team prior to my arrival at the company had kind of naively tried to use a graph database for, I don't even recall the specific problem, but it was a miserable failure. And after that, there was a lot of sort of skepticism about, you know, graph being a buzzword and people not really understanding what they were doing and just kind of running with it. So I was kind of told that, you know, we needed to hedge a little bit our bet on this technology, which it was fair, I suppose. Not my favorite, but okay. So now this next slide is kind of intense. I'm just going straight into the back end. How many of you are familiar with Janus Graph? Okay. So Janus Graph, it plays nicely with a pluggable set of back-end components, and it kind of orchestrates a client's interaction among those back-end components. So the two big ones are an indexing system and the data system itself. In our case, we use Solar Cloud for the indexing and Cassandra for the data layer. And our choice of Solar Cloud was because Nordstrom has a lot of experience with Solar Cloud. That's how we do our search and browse on the website. So we knew we had some internal knowledge that we could lean on if necessary. So with that in mind, there's these different sort of independent pieces that Janus Graph is responsible for orchestrating your interactions among them. Brace yourselves for this. It's a little bit intense. But this is a diagram of how our system looks like in the Kubernetes cluster. And these applications with the clients at the top, those are just generic clients or applications that we aim to support. The back end is really what we refer to as our solution. The back end paired with the client. So I don't know how many of you are familiar with Kubernetes, but each of these are sort of slightly more and more complex deployments in Kubernetes. Cassandra is a single Helm chart. Solar Cloud is a single Helm chart, so you can just a single command deploy that, and it sets up in Kubernetes, and it gets up and running. And then same with Zookeeper. You can express the dependencies among these. But it really abstracts the sort of details of the deployment and the configuration, so that it's very well encapsulated. Then what our team did on top of that was roll all of that up into a single Helm chart, so that we can deploy our entire back end with a single Helm chart, come back probably in 10 minutes, and it's ready to run in Kubernetes. All of these pieces, they're already configured at the end of that to interact with each other, and it leaves a config map, which is basically a set of properties that clients can use to connect to the back end. This is what Janus Graph generally expects when you connect to a graph. So now, kind of moving back up, the client is something that we also developed, and there's a Janus Graph logo there. This was kind of part of... We decided to use the embedded Janus Graph style of deployment, which means that the Janus Graph client runs within the same JVM as your application. This was kind of to reduce the complexity. As you can see, it's already kind of, it looks complex. So that was part of it. And yeah, there were a couple like sort of political concerns, but we've actually been pretty pleased with it. So the client is really the thing that's most interesting here. And on the next slide, we'll dive in. Here I've borrowed an excellent diagram from the Janus Graph docs. And this big piece sort of illustrates what Janus Graph is doing specifically. So these are all the sort of services that it can handle for you by using your back-end pieces. So in the referring to the previous slide, the JVM application would have been one of the applications. Then this whole green box here would have been what we call the client. So Janus Graph Libs that's what they ship. And the other pieces are pieces that my team, we're called the Promise Team. Those are pieces that we've developed and we own. And we'll dig into those a little bit more. But this is kind of the application model from the client's perspective. So this is also related to, you know, our plan to hedge on unfamiliar technology. So we need to be able to hand this client out to other teams that are using our backend, querying our backend, and trying to understand that information. We couldn't ask all of them to understand Janus Graph and TinkerPop and all of the sort of graph-specific stuff that our team is happily understands and that we work with on a daily basis. But when we pass the client out, we can't ask them to all, okay, now you gotta use this graph sort of style of interacting with us. This kind of kept us honest in that way, and by developing it this way, it kept us honest with so that we weren't leaking those dependencies that we had out to our clients. And we actually did kind of vet this with an alternate implementation instead of Janus Graph using Dynamo, which was awkward, but it proved it out. So this describes at the highest level how our system works. The back end paired with the client, those two things combined pretty much offer us everything that we're looking for. So now, how do we use these things to solve the Holy Grail at Nordstrom, which we called cost-based routing? So routing... just to go over a couple definitions, we call that, that's the process we use to assign parts of a customer's order to particular facilities for fulfillment. So earlier when we saw socks, shoes, and jackets, routing might say, okay, socks and shoes should come from facility one, jacket comes from facility two. So it's kind of what you would expect. Now, cost-based routing is what is really the holy grail at Nordstrom, and that's where we perform that routing task, and after meeting all the customer's expectations, we make an effort to globally minimize the cost to Nordstrom for fulfillment. So, yeah, this is the problem that we engage data science from the outset to collaborate on, and here I'll show you the initial output of what data science gave us when we asked for their input. So this is obviously kind of overwhelming when you first see it, and it I think this more than anything kind of helps illustrate like the sheer complexity of the problem. You know, you have the network, and then you have all of these various variables that affect how things move through the network, and it's not feasible to compute all of those things in real time when the customer makes a request. So we ask data science or to help us to understand, you know, okay, how do we break this problem down into meaningful pieces? And this is what they came back with, this constellation. A lot of these are individual models, machine learning models. Some of them then are like sort of these meta models or ensemble type things. Some of them are just inputs, but it's each unit in here is some volume of work for our team. And so this is also kind of why we needed to be adaptable that I was mentioning earlier. Let's walk through how we tackled just one of these models, and it'll illustrate how we're using the back end overall. So one model here is called First Fill, and what it means is, or what the model predicts is the likelihood that a node will fill an assigned subset of an order the first time it's assigned. So nodes can fail to fulfill an order. They can reject it. They can say, we just can't do it right now. They can just silently, you know, not do anything. So what we're trying to understand is, what is the likelihood that this node just fulfills it? There's no cancellation, no reject. So that's just this one tiny part of the constellation that the data science org shared with us. And it has 10 features alone. Some of these are sort of very rapidly changing features that we have to ask about at request time. But other ones aren't things that are changing so rapidly, so we can kind of settle those in advance. And what it came into was this sort of notion of a pipeline, and where we're reading or consuming a bunch of data from Kafka streams. It's basically various types of like telemetry data or instrumentation about the physical supply chain. So is one store fulfilling orders at a faster rate? Is another store low on staff? There's all kinds of different signals that we're trying to pick up, and then we're using those signals to evaluate these models. So this pipeline concept is something we kept returning to, and it basically looks like ingestion of telemetry data, then there's some sort of reconciliation of that data taking primitive data and coming up with derivative data from it, and then finally serving that when customers make requests. So I kind of have like a Fisher-Price, my first pipeline illustration here. So this is the first fill pipeline. And once again, this is all running in Kubernetes. So here, you can kind of see all of the pieces that are coming together just for that one first fill model. We have this Kafka consumer, and what it's ingesting this telemetry data, and it's placing it in the graph using the promise client that we talked about earlier. Then we have a Spark job that is, you know, reconciling some of that primitive data and creating derivative data. In this case, they call it a queue length. It creates any intermediate data it needs for service. And then the first fill service takes that data and reads it out of the back end, the Cassandra and Solar Cloud, using the Janus Graph client. And it evaluates the first fill model at request time. So we have this sort of flow that we kept seeing over and over and over. So this would be one pipeline, if you imagine this earlier slide. All of that corresponds with this one pipeline here. So now, if you imagine we're working to implement all of these machine learning models for the data science approach to cost-based routing, then we're going to end up with potentially dozens of these pipelines that are all running simultaneously. And so that's the kind of the volume that our backend built on Janus Graph needs to support. This was the first example of going to production. We've gone to production now with a few of these pipelines, and it's working pretty well. I'll talk a little bit about how, you know, we've worked on this from a development perspective. So the graph schema we derive from Java annotations on just POJO objects. Early on, we were kind of running into this multiple sources of truth with the schema. So we found that it was very useful to have the schema live with the code. And so we have some mechanism for reading those annotations and installing the schema into the Janus Graph backend. Today, the fully populated graph has about 1 million vertices and 100 million edges. So obviously, I said we only have about 115 or 150 facilities earlier. We also have SKUs in there. So those are the set of items that we sell. And there's a lot of different shipping options, and there's relationships there that sort of, once you have those million vertices, then just getting those connections, we end up with about 100 million edges. Today, we're processing about 100 million daily events through that backend with the concurrent pipelines. We expect this to increase by an order, one to two orders of magnitude. We haven't had really any problems with it. So we're pretty optimistic about increasing that load. And as part of proving this out, we had to do a cost analysis, and we've noticed about a 10x reduction in our actual dollar spend versus DynamoDB solution. So that's a pretty serious improvement. We still don't know the TCO. Obviously, Dynamo has a lot of benefits there, so we still have to measure that. And then going to production, So like we talked about, these pipelines, they sort of form a mix of OLAP and OLTP style interactions with the graph. Anywhere from 20 to 100 plus concurrent interactions with the graph. And those happen, you know, at schedules that we don't really control. So not having any major problems to date has been, honestly a surprise. And I think it's to the credit of Janice Graph. And, it's been a real pleasure. There's only been one sort of serious bug that was a problem for us. And that was, it's been fixed since in Janice Graph. And that was, it blocked the use of Spark Graph Computer with the SQL backend. We were able to work around that by, coding up our own custom Spark jobs, but we're happy that's fixed now. So what have we learned from all of this? So complexity is real. Like for a system like this, when you're trying to operate it in production, like you can't be naive about it. It's real. You need to just acknowledge that up front and plan for it. Disciplined DevOps is a huge key. Like we had to all agree that was a priority for us. Jar dependencies could become confusing at times, especially with Spark involved. So we have several different sort of complicated projects that are all coming together to form this back end. And sometimes we found that jar conflicts cause sort of bizarre problems that were difficult to resolve. Our use of Helm charts, like I described earlier, was a huge win. I highly recommend it for Kubernetes users. It made our configuration A. It really is configuration as code, which so we're getting source control on it and tracking. And when you have all these complex systems that individually are hard to manage, having something like Helm charts to help you really made it much easier. Even today, complete migration to Java 11 seems like it's pretty far off. And it's another kind of symptom of the same problem when you have all of these pieces coming together. Like, it's not easy to get them all on Java 11. So another thing that early on we had a lot of trouble with is developers on our team, they didn't have a good feel for the graph data. And it was sort of a black box to them. And obviously there's Groovy, or maybe not obviously, but there's a Groovy and like a REPL style interaction that you can use to query the graph. But people were just kind of put off by that, and it really helped for them to be able to visualize the graph data. So we started down the path. We're still building it out. But, using D3, we've been able to build this, like, nice visualization application where we can see into the back end, and this has helped our developers immensely. They can sort of interact with the graph itself, and for those coming from no SQL or SQL background, like, this kind of speeds up the learning process and helps them get a real feel for what this data looks like. The value of being able to visualize it was something that I think we underestimated early on, and now we're investing in that on the regular. What's next for Nordstrom? We have a couple of security fixes that our operations required us to use mutual TLS across everything, and so we're looking to push those upstream. It's wrapped up in our legal department right now, so hopefully they'll get off it soon, and we can push those upstream. We need to codify these pipeline schemas as DAGs themselves. It's sort of like how airflow works, so that we can promote the pipeline concept to like a first class citizen in our world. One valuable outcome of that is, for example, if we want to test a new data model from data science, then we can actually run side by side at the same time multiple versions of a pipeline and refer to this one as V2 and this one as V1. And so we want to really double down on this concept of the pipeline schema and formalize it. I know there's some open source activity or quite a bit around that, so maybe we'll adopt something or maybe we'll roll around. I'm not sure. We want to continue development of the visualization. That's also been a big selling point for our adoption of Graph, is being able to show them this tool where they can interact with the network. They're very used to just sort of Excel spreadsheets and you know, almost like access queries, things like that. And so we think beyond just our developers being able to browse the data, we want to be able to hand that out so that everyone in the supply chain can use it to interact with the data, and in some cases maybe even affect how the supply chain behaves. This next one's interesting. The Janus Graph uses a particular data model with Cassandra. Basically, each row is a vertex, and all of the edges are in that row for the vertex. So if you have certain patterns of I/O, it may work well, but with Cassandra, you really have to understand what your workload is shaped like, and then kind of work a data model back from that. We're a little boxed in with the data model that we inherited with Janus Graph, so we need to experiment with our workload and understand how we can improve that. Like, tombstones have been something that have been a little bit concerning. In Kubernetes, Zookeeper we inherited with the Solar Cloud dependency, and in Kubernetes, Zookeeper isn't as necessary in our opinion. So we, as a way of reducing complexity, we might investigate how to decouple Solar Cloud from explicitly using Zookeeper and replacing that with some kind of Kubernetes native solution. So, those are our next steps. We've been very happy with Janus Graph and adopting Graph. We had to convince some skeptics early on, but I think pushing ahead, we've been able to convince them, and everyone's pretty happy with it now. So that's what I got today. I don't know, any questions? Yep.
Clarify, what are you representing with the graph?
What
are you actually representing with the graph? Is that the network of plants?
It's the supply chain network itself, along with the inventory, which is distributed through the network, and then we pull in all of that telemetry style data, and that. So there's sort of a durable structure that's modeled, and that's the supply chain network. It only changes sort of infrequently, the structure itself. And then there's sort of what we call the behavior of the supply chain, and that's stuff that's changing constantly. So that's where we're kind of the property graph style. We're using that for all these sort of constantly changing telemetry signals about the supply chain. And then the inventory itself are, those are the items that we sell. And so those are also live in the graph. A lot of questions come down to where, what inventory is, lives together. So, for example, you basically want to consolidate an order into as few nodes as possible. That's a, you know, I'm speaking generically, but so knowing where inventory resides and when it resides in the same place is something that's very useful for us. Having that in the graph has been, it's simplified the way we query. So I have numbers at the office. I should have included them. We came from using Dynamo, and we wanted to try Janus Graph, and we wanted to try graph sort of approach to this, because we found that using like a straight, like the Dynamo model, it was just a lot of combined sort of queries that had to be managed, and they were hard to evolve. So there was a time actually when Amazon had a DynamoDB backend for Janus Graph that was out on GitHub. I don't know if it remains, but this was prior to Neptune coming out, and we tried that. And any sort of like Spark, like OLAP style, like, you know, highly concurrent writes. It wasn't very effective. I don't have the specific numbers, but as soon as we tried Cassandra in lieu of Dynamo, throughput just blowing through there. So. Compared to not using Janus Graph, like another sort of non-graph data model, there were other reasons that we wanted to try this. One of them is we thought that it simplified the way that developers interacted with the backend. So certain queries that would have been, like I said earlier, a series of queries that were written in code and had these relationships, those collapsed into a single query. That was very sort of natural, semantically, it was very natural to think about it that way. The being able to evolve the schema is also something that has been really helpful. We don't really ever think about the schema in Cassandra. We only think about the schema that we tell Janus Graph about, and so that is another reason that we ended up choosing it. So I think that we didn't entirely, you know, compare it to non-graph solutions, because we had a pretty strong idea that we wanted to go that way. But once we did, we tried it with Dynamo, didn't really have much success, and that's where we landed.
In terms of, there is another graph technology called Neo4j, to model a decent sized problem there, you need bigger boxes because they are not able to partition the graph in a horizontally scalable fashion.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a more data set, you buy a bigger box, just like Oracle. So do you have such issues with Janus Graph, or is it horizontally scalable? I saw that you mentioned about embedded Janus Graphs that you're using. I'm curious, how does it work, meaning the data lives in Cassandra, but then what is Janus Graph doing? Because I'm not aware of it, so pardon my ignorance.
Oh, no, of course. That's why we're here. So the decision to use embedded Janus Graph was partially tactical, because we knew that we were going to have to get this vetted and go through a design review process and these kinds of things. And already looking at this without deploying independent JanusGraph servers, we can see that it looks a little, I mean, there's some complexity here, right? And so our choice of embedded JanusGraph was a little bit tactical. But with respect to the individual backend pieces, yeah, I mean, it's not a problem to scale them. And yeah, Kubernetes makes it pretty easy. And so there's still inherent data complications. Like they refer to them as supernodes, where they have a massive number of incoming edges or outgoing edges or both. And so those can present a problem, but it's not so much related to box size or the data size. It's more about at query time, like how do you attack going through all of those edges.
Also, does JanusGraph need to be aware of other servers? Like, how does it coordinate? Like, okay, these are the other nodes that are there in the cluster, say. So, Zookeeper or something?
There's coordination in terms of just interacting with these back-end systems that we've selected. So that, I mean, is just configuration. But there's no coordination among the clients in terms of like data integrity, that kind of thing.
Right.
So, an eventually consistent back-end and things right. The good thing is, the types of decisions we make off these things can afford a little bit of error there. So we're not making like major financial transactions based on this, right? And so if we end up selecting one node instead of another, but we still meet the customer's expectations, then maybe it costs us a little extra, but hopefully we're saving that by simplifying some of the consistency requirements. I saw yours first.
So you mentioned that you don't really worry about the Cassandra schema back end. I'm curious, do you have to manage anything specific with Cassandra, like a compaction strategy, replication factor, or is that just sort of handled through JanusGraph?
So, yes. I mean, JanusGraph can participate in that configuration, but tombstones in particular is something that has really alarmed us a little bit, where Cassandra is just a immutable, like, write-forward store, and when tombstones are created when you delete data or you update existing data, and so if we have these constantly changing edges or nodes in our graph, then we end up trying to figure out how to deal with that tombstone situation. And there's a new compaction strategy, newish, called time window compaction strategy, but it doesn't work well when the data is intermingled with older data, which is kind of the model that that JanusGraph uses in the way that we've specified our graph. So vertices and those in particular tend to be durable for us, and the edges and properties change frequently. So you end up with tombstones within rows, and that ends up kind of interfering with the operation of the time window compaction strategy. So yeah, I definitely think you have to be eyes wide open about, like, you're operating a Cassandra cluster. You're operating a solar cloud cluster. And because JanusGraph's good at its job, sometimes it's easy to not sort of acknowledge that. But in reality, like, I mean, you're operating a Zookeeper solar cloud Cassandra cluster, and you need to have your pager duty or whatever it is set up, and you need to understand how to monitor it and metrics and all that. Yeah.
So it sounds like you have this really update-heavy workload for Cassandra, which is like one of its weaknesses. I guess I'm curious, have you ever had an issue with a Cassandra node going down and having that information not being propagated properly because you're not really actively tweaking the replication factor, right?
No, we're not. No, the replication factor stays the same. We did, because we were facing skepticism, we did an intense round of just sort of load testing with what we thought were production style loads, and we kind of monitored different things and saw what was problematic. One sort of advantage to our data model is everything except for the vertices is flushed every 90 days. And so we have a very good sense of what the max is, right? And so our scaling is more about just managing read repairs, stuff like that. It's not about trying to, add nodes as often.
What are the maximum, if you know on the top of your head, what are the maximum number of vertices or the edges coming out of a single vertex?
For us?
Yes.
Probably about 40,000, I would guess. Yeah. So that ends up creating pretty wide
row on Cassandra.
Right.
Do you guys have that wide row issues or you have to deal with it in some form, or was there a strategy that...
No, that hasn't really been a problem for us. So I mean, and that's also not something that we expect to change. Like I don't expect that we'll see a large increase there. We did. I will say, there is one place I should have said with. We needed to do like a bucket-style schema for dividing some edges up into groups, so that to avoid having like 1.5 million edges there. So I guess we did actually deal with that problem. But now everything using that strategy, which was a very simple, just like almost an index type thing, we're able to keep our edge counts relatively low. Yeah, thanks.